The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by
Vale Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca.
And joining us now on the debate for the full hour tonight, Kathleen Wynne, Ontario's Minister of Education, David Clegg, President of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, Annie Kidder, Executive Director of People for Education, Ken Corrin, President of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, and Carol Solomon, Grade 1-2 teacher at Holy Name Catholic School in Toronto. And I welcome everybody on both sides of the table to our discussion here at TVO tonight. First question is a pretty obvious one. Before winning his first election, Dalton McGuinty said he wanted to be known when he was finished politics as the education premier. He's been premier for a little more than 5 years now. Annie, to you first. You know I'm not going to ask you this question first. There's not a chance I'm going to go to you first on this. Can he legitimately call himself that today?
Yes and no. I think yes, in terms of it's a massive improvement over what it was like before. I think there has been a real commitment to public education, a real care and a real understanding about why it's important. And there have been real improvements across the board in schools. So in that way, yes, absolutely. I think we would like a little bit more vision, a little bit bigger vision beyond the test scores, the graduation rates, and the, you know, something broader than that, and maybe more sort of forward looking into the 21st century. So a qualified yes. Maybe.
Qualified yes. David Clegg, what do you say?
Well, I think to have earned that title, you would have had to do something that's profoundly different, positive, and lasting. And from the perspective of elementary teachers, I think it's fair to say the verdict's out. Certainly the first 4 years we saw promise, but the last 2 years have not certainly brought to public elementary teachers the issues, the problems that we brought forward have not been dealt with.
And the big issue for you is the equality in treatment.
Equality in treatment, funding treatment, certainly having the opportunities for professionals to work in our schools in the manner we would like to.
And that means being paid the same amount as his teachers.
Well, we've always had. Up until about a month ago, that was not an issue. Now it's an issue again. And that is profoundly disturbing to us.
Okay, the his is you, Ken.
That's correct.
From the OSSTF's point of view, is he the education premier?
Certainly moving in the right direction. I think it may be a little premature to give that that notation to him yet, but he's certainly moving in the right direction.
Why
and
is
making
it premature?
Positive moves. Well, I mean, I would reference a sports figure. You know, is Sidney Crosby the best hockey player ever? It's too early to tell.
Okay, so but
we'll take it.
But yeah,
he's a good player. So if you put that in perspective,
so
I think
Sid the Kid may be someday the greatest ever, but you're not prepared to say it yet.
I'm saying he's moving in the right direction.
Moving
he's
right
had
direction.
Some great initiatives, and he's certainly moved education to the forefront.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Sid there. Okay, okay, Carol, your turn.
Okay, well, I have to say definitely, and I've canvassed my staff on this, people at my school. Definitely, there's such a vast, vast improvement, which is not to say we still don't have concerns and issues, but we feel that we have a government that we can work with and that is interested in letting us do what we do, which is look after our children. So,
at the risk of asking a silly question, you said a vast improvement. Over what?
Over, well, I'm an old teacher. I've been teaching for 23 years, and I remember the time before Mr. McGuinty. And they were very different, and those of us who went through them remember them, and we feel like a lot of damage was done, and we're glad there's been a change.
Okay, I can't not ask her, right?
I know,
so, okay,
I know.
Kathleen Wynne, is he Wayne Gretzky or is he Sidney Crosby?
Oh, I'm going to say the great one.
Well,
here's the thing. When we came into office in 2003, we came into a demoralized education sector, you know, and I had been a parent activist, had been a school trustee, I'd been in schools for years as a parent with my own kids, and we had a system that was demoralized in terms of the relationships among people in the sector and between the sector and government, demoralized in terms of student achievement, buildings that were being neglected. There was just a sense that the publicly funded education system was fraying and was not moving forward. So in terms of the task before us, we had to repair all of those things, and we had to put the education system on a track that was, to my mind, going to make it the best education system in the world. And I really believe that's what we've done. And if we look at objective measures, so we can talk about the improvements in test scores, which have been 11% overall, the improvements in graduation rate, we came in, it was 68%, it's 77% yesterday.
Those are
some of the measures. But in terms of people coming from around the world and looking at what we're doing and saying, how have you managed to have steady improvement every year since you've been in office? Those are the kinds of measures and I think, you know, the sort of opinions that we need to look to.
Annie, has this government genuinely treated teachers better than previous governments?
That's exactly what I wanted to say, and to sort of follow on with what Kathleen's saying and what you said. I think that one of the things that's great is that conversations about public education are no longer always a kind of polarized debate. It's not always, you know, which side are you on? Pick a side, have the fight. Everybody isn't going, no, we're putting children first. No, we're putting children first. There's a sense that there's a real conversation happening. So even when I'm critical, it's a conversation. And it's not you guys are bad and doing bad things. And the response isn't like that either, that there seems to be a genuine desire to talk about public education and its potential. And I think in that way, and from, I'm not in a federation, but in terms of the sort of labor peace that's happened over the last few years, and the sense that it's not, the instability isn't there. Mm-hmm. Because there was,
let me put this to Carol. My recollection of the Harris years, and that's what everybody's mm-hmm. dancing right
yes,
here, the Mike
right
Harris
there.
Years when the conservatives were in power, was that he didn't have a problem with you. He liked teachers. He didn't like teacher union heads. And he made the distinction. It was these two guys he didn't like, although not you in particular, because you weren't there then. But that was the difference. Did you not see that distinction
You didn't? Not at all. And I think certainly the public that we dealt with didn't see that distinction. And the press didn't see that distinction. And our employers didn't see that distinction. So, no.
I really believe individual teachers felt vilified.
Yeah.
Individual
Definitely.
Parents felt
yeah.
vilified.
We
you
were.
Know, parents
we were.
And teachers who stood up and said, publicly funded education is really important, were smacked down as special interest groups,
yeah, yeah.
or they were marginalized. So those relationships were absolutely tatters. And, you know, the process of rebuilding those relationships, bringing people into the conversation about policy and setting up structures like a partnership table, like working tables, where we actually develop policy together, that's what's repaired the relationships.
But some people have said that the difference in the relationship right now is that you guys, you liberals, have been prepared to sort of pay for labor peace. You've paid a high price. You've got certainly a more peaceful province today, but not necessarily better. That's the question.
Well, you know, okay, there are critics who will say that, but what I'm saying to you is that it's not just about the money that's gone into the system. That's extremely important, and there's been more than $4 billion that's gone into the system and more coming. But what is important is the ongoing relationship that has allowed us to develop policies that, in fact, are working in our schools because we've developed them in cooperation with teachers.
What do you say on that?
Well, I think from the perspective of elementary teachers, there are some profound policy choices this government hasn't made, in particular when it comes to the funding of elementary students versus secondary students. We have been talking to this government for now six years about that problem.
And is it the funding of the students or the funding of the teachers?
It's the funding of the system at the elementary level, and it affects both. I'll be very candid about that. It affects both. But clearly, from our perspective, the opportunity for elementary students is not being fully realized, whether it's class sizes at the junior intermediate level, whether it's the lack of specialist teachers, whether it's the lack of librarians in every school. Those things aren't the resources that we believe this government should be working towards. It's a simple question for us. Do you believe that elementary students should be provided the same resource base as secondary students? And we've yet to have a clear answer on that.
Well, let's get one tonight. What's the answer to that question?
Well, you know, the way we have put resources into the system, and there are thousands more teachers, and the majority of those are elementary teachers, because we have put teachers in place to reduce those class sizes in the kindergarten to grade 3. The latest framework agreement is going to put teachers in to reduce class sizes in those 4 to 8 years, not to cap them, fair enough, but to provide some class size reductions. So, you know, in terms of the resources we've put into the system, we've put the resources in where we believe they're
okay,
needed.
Okay, but philosophically, do you believe that elementary and secondary ought to be funded equally?
Well, first of all, the teachers are paid equally. I mean, David acknowledged that that has been the situation. So in terms of the actual treatment of the individual teachers, I think the jury's out, in fact, on the exact dollar amounts between elementary and secondary. I think we have to look at other jurisdictions. We have to look at what the overall costs are. But my point, Steve, is that we need to put money where the money is needed. And that's what we've tried to do. We've tried to look at the system and say, look, this is a need. We need specialist high skills majors
lots
in secondary.
David first, then Annie.
Well, talk about the class size issue. Junior intermediate class sizes, they're the largest in the public school system. The government's initiative around this is to see them reduced, so they recognize they're too high. Yet they don't have compliance mechanisms in place that actually make the investment happen on the ground. We have school boards today, Avon Maitland in southwestern Ontario. They have the largest junior intermediate class sizes in the province. They're outside of what the government's funding. They're funded at 25-1, yet they're able to actually staff at 27.5-1 on a ratio basis. That's significant.
90% of the classes, though, are 20 and less, right? Isn't that the case?
At the primary level, but I'm talking grade 4 to grade 8.
Okay.
In grade 4 to grade 8, we've been saying that they need to reduce those class sizes. The money actually not just has to be invested, but there has to be mechanisms to make compliance happen. That's simple. That's something the government can do. They haven't done that, and we still see large class sizes.
Annie?
Well, I guess to me, what's important is not so much the money, or should it be the same, or talking about it in that much detail, but that first, and it goes back to whether or not the premier is the education premier, it has to do with describing the vision and defining and talking about or building the conversation about what should elementary schools look like? What makes a difference? What doesn't make a difference? We have been talking for years about the loss of teacher librarians, specialist teachers. So what should elementary schools have? Is it important that they have libraries? Should they be open full-time? Should they have teacher librarians in them? Should there be more specialist teachers in different subjects down into the earlier grades? But that's a conversation that needs to happen, I think, before we get to the point of should it be the same or what are the dollars? But actually, to really truly define, we're in the 21st century, should we still be doing things in the same way in all our elementary schools?
That's a broader, more philosophical
it's a bigger one, I think,
well,
first.
Carol, we wanted you on tonight because, of course, you're the only one on this table who's in the classroom every single day. You're doing you're on the front lines, as it were. So talk to us about class size. What does it look like from where you stand?
From where I stand, I teach in an inner city school, and it's been years since I've had a class that was larger than 20 children. And when I first started teaching, I routinely had 27 children. And it makes a huge difference.
But you do a split class, right? You do 1-2?
Yes. Yes, I do a 1-2.
So is it okay to have 27 in a 1-2 class?
A 27 in a 1-2? I would say it's not okay to have 27 in any class. Especially a primary class. But having said that, in our school we have our grade 7 teacher has 35 children, and the room's wall-to-wall desks. I mean, it's not perfect, but again, we've just seen such an improvement, and hopefully that's the direction we're going.
What can you say to her?
Well,
on that?
What I can say is that I'm very aware of the grade 4 to 8 years, and in fact, at every elementary meeting that I've been to since I was appointed minister, we've had that conversation about those grade 4 to 8 years, which is why when we went into this, into the last election and into this round of collective bargaining, you know, I was very clear that one of the things we wanted to do was get some more resources into those grade 4 to 8 years. The fact is that there isn't any research that says that class size alone is the thing that will make those junior years go better for kids. What you also need is great teaching and great hands-on learning, opportunities for kids
to
engage.
But you did run on it and you promised it. Class size, right? Smaller class size.
Well, we've delivered what we promised, Steve. We said we were going to reduce class sizes in kindergarten to grade 3. We said we were going to cap class sizes, and we've done that. We've reached that objective. So 90% of the kindergarten to grade 3 classes are 20 students or fewer, and the rest are up to 23. We didn't say that we were going to cap the grade 4 to 8, because as I say, there isn't any research that says that's what we should do. But we know that those kids need more hands-on learning and more opportunities, and that's what we're trying to do, is get those resources into those years.
Can I talk to you about money? Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. You guys just went through a very tough set of negotiations on the issue of trying to get a new collective agreement. And unlike, I think, all of the other, or at least the vast majority of the other, is it all of the other?
Yeah.
Unlike all of the other unions in the province, which went for this sort of upfront 3% a year over 4 years, we'll give you a better deal if you settle faster, as opposed to we don't know if you want to take your time. You guys took your time, and from what I could see, you didn't get as good a deal as everybody else.
Well, from our perspective,
what do you think your teachers think about that?
Well, I think our teachers are quite disappointed in the government. I think that they don't understand why elementary, public elementary teachers are going to be the lowest paid teachers over the next 4 years. Because simply what we were trying to do was raise the very issue we've been talking about trying to find ways to make good investments in elementary education. We took the investment that the government had available and we rejigged it, made an offer that we thought was in the best interest of the students and ultimately the economy, by suggesting we would take a little bit more money up front, but overall have a lower percentage increase in salary, and then reinvest the savings in classroom teachers and in doing the very thing that we believe is profoundly important for elementary students in this province. And the School Boards Association said no. The government had the opportunity, if they chose to resurrect that type of arrangement, they said no. So the conclusion elementary teachers have in this province is that when you raise a question of fairness about funding, and you stand by your principles, you get punished.
Okay, I mean, everybody wants fairness, but then there's the political reality at the end of the day. And the political reality from where you sit at the end of the day is that your members got less money than everybody else because they didn't settle fast enough.
Well, I don't think it was a question of settling fast enough. I really believe it was a question of there not being a willingness to look at the problems that elementary teachers were raising and dealing with them specifically. It became a one-size-fits-all solution to the bargaining from our perspective.
Well,
it was the same salary for everyone. It was the same for the elementary people across the province. It was the same type of working condition issues that were dealt with in a pattern. Ours were different, and we believed fundamentally that if you're going to bargain in good faith, you're going to solve the problems that confront you. And the elementary teachers saw them as different.
Annie, I want to hear you on this. This is hard to ask you to kind of weigh in on this, get between the union and the ministry on this one. But the reality is these guys made a decision. One could argue, in the fullness of time, it turned out not to be the right decision. Did teachers not do as well if they were elementary teachers in this province because they didn't settle fast enough?
I am loath to get in the middle of this. I guess from our point of view, as parents and as a sort of public education organization, we wished for two separate conversations to be happening, because we felt that the elementary teachers were raising good and important issues about specialist teachers, about the number of teachers, and even about class size. But I actually agree with Kathleen that we have to be careful about how much money we put into class size. And so the issues raised were good. I think we thought it would have been good to be raising them not as part of a bargaining, because it made it hard then to go, this is a really important conversation, but when we're having it now, I am loath to get in the middle. You end up on sides again. You end up going, you have to be on one side or the other because it's about bargaining, not even though we agree that it is an issue. It's hard to plunk it in the middle of bargaining because it's about trying to win. Bargaining is about trying to win.
You're very skillfully kind of not answering the question. I've got to hand it to you. It's impressive. I know you didn't want to. I think the lady beside you may take a better crack at it, though. Were they poorly represented, you think, the union in this last set of negotiations?
Well, you know what? I don't want to get into renegotiating that. No, I don't want to have that conversation again. And I think we have to remember that there's another elementary teacher sitting at this table. David doesn't represent all the elementary teachers in the province. And so I think we have to be clear that there was a particular position that David took, and it is his right to take that position. In my role as the minister, I had to put the very best offer that I could on the table. And I told all the federations and unions when we started the process more than a year ago that I was going to go to the mat for them, And the economy had not had not tanked at that point. And so we got, you know, we got what I think was a pretty generous set of provisions. The salary, plus more teachers for grade 4 to 8, some special teachers in grade 7, 8. We got more teachers for secondary. We got more support staff workers. So it was really a good, I thought, a really good offer. I understand that David had to take the position that he had to take, but we also had to put some deadlines in place. You know, by the end of this process, I had the finance minister breathing down my back because there was clear evidence that we were going to be in trouble in terms of our finances. We had to get this settled. The boards had to know what they were going to be
and
dealing with.
And you extended your deadline.
And we extended the deadline, and I did the very best that I could to get
okay,
the
David,
deal.
And then I want to hear Ken.
But my point is this. The offer that we put on the table in December met all of the financial parameters that had been set. And in doing that, we would have ended up with our teachers having less salary at the end of 4 years than other teachers, but we would have made a fair trade in exchange for 1,500 new jobs being created in a province that needs jobs, and having students have their education improved. That was our position. It's one that we find very defensible, and it's one that ultimately the government could have picked up even after the December 5th deadline.
David, I think, you know, as I said, I don't want to get into this conversation. I don't want to renegotiate this. But the reality is that the proposals that were being made, and there were a number that went back and forth in that first round, were going to cost the government more money than we had. That's the bottom line. And I think you know that.
Well, no, I don't accept that.
Well,
and there was
okay.
never that conversation.
Okay,
so
let me
that's
get
the reality.
Let's get the conversation going with Ken.
Yeah, I want to spin the conversation around a little bit. And we were talking about the premier being the education premier. One thing the premier has done is appoint great people as minister. And I'm not saying that because Kathleen Wynne is here. She's someone that cares. She's knowledgeable. And as she says, she had a big fight on her hands to get the funding she got from the, I guess, the management board or the Ministry of Finance to fund education. So I think we have to give the premier and this minister for credit for that. The big issue, it was a new process for bargaining. You know, there are weaknesses, there are strengths to any new process. I know our organization is committed to totally reviewing the process, and I'm sure the government is doing likewise when the whole round of bargaining is done. So it was new. Believe me, they put time, energy, they were resourceful, they had resources, you know, they had people.
Can I make an observation? You guys settled really quickly, the OSSTF, which kind of surprised me, I must say, because you guys usually, you know.
You know why we settled quickly?
Tell me.
Because that framework provided us what we wanted. You know, we realize you can't get everything all at once. You make slow, gradual improvements.
Well, and I shouldn't say, actually, you settled all over the place. I do happen to have in my hands here. I have. Which camera do you want me to show this to? Over here? Camera one? Okay, Kevin, let's get this. If you picked up your Toronto Star today, you saw the back page. Here's 30,000 of your union dollars at work. I'm sure John Hondrick's happy about that. These Toronto District School Board trustees are prepared to put up with more kids in every class. And they're the, I was going to say dirty dozen, but there's more than a dozen here. And then the question from the OSSTF, are you prepared to put up with that? Ken, what's this all about?
Well, we established a provincial framework. I did say it was a new process. The biggest part of the process was establishing the framework, and that took days, hours, weeks to negotiate. And when that framework was established, the intent was then to negotiate local issues with the individual school boards. And that served our purposes. We wanted to have the monetary issues basically dealt with by the province because they control the purse strings. And we wanted the other issues to be dealt with that our local unions, our local reps had identified.
What's not happening?
Here's the problem. Well, the problem is this. This school board, I would classify very much right now as a rogue board. And
Toronto.
The Toronto District School Board. And it's not all of those trustees, so I don't want all trustees to be painted with the same brush. I mean, I'm sure there are trustees that are in opposition over this topic.
Here's you guys just the
sure,
other day.
Sure, we just had a rally this afternoon at 4:30, and I have to give credit to our local. There were 3,000 of the 6,500 teachers there. That's one out of every two teachers was present to show their support for our local union. So this issue is an issue to them. The government provided $51 million extra dollars to the Toronto District School Board that they decided to turn their backs on. Now, today at a meeting, they are talking about a deficit of $23 million. So they're going to cut 150 EA positions, and I believe it's 23 teacher librarian positions. So they're saying on one hand they don't have money, so they're cutting jobs, and then they turn their backs on $51 million that the province was going to give them.
So your beef is not really with the province at all?
my beef is not with, our beef is not with the province at all. You're absolutely right. The beef is with the Toronto District School Board, and in particular, their chair, John Hawkins.
Okay.
John Campbell, sorry.
John Campbell.
Can I just make a sure. comment on the process? Because, you know, what Ken says is really important. We built on the process that was undertaken by the previous Minister of Education when we first came into office, which was the first sort of provincial discussion. We've refined it, but now we're going to have to look at what we've done over the last year, and we're going to have to say, okay, what have we learned from this, and do we need to move down the road towards a more formalized, because this was really a voluntary process. I called people together, I said, we need to have a provincial discussion to get these big money items out of the way, and then you go to your local tables. Now we need to figure out whether there needs to be a more formalized process.
Okay. I want to talk some more policy here. We've talked about the class sizes in the early years. Carol, let me bring you in now and talk about something that the government has been, it's been a big part of what they're trying to bring forward, the Safe Schools Initiative, reporting on student-on-student violence, anti-bullying measures, this kind of thing. Again, from the front lines, from where you stand, how's that all working?
Well, this is one of the concerns that is very much in evidence at our school, and I think you talk to any teacher, especially, and I'm in a primary division teacher, so I speak mostly to that. There's been a tremendous increase, I would say, over the past 10 years in the number of severe behavior issues in the primary grades, and children in distress, and mental health issues.
Tell us what that means.
Mental health issues, diagnoses, autism is on the rise. If you ask any teacher, that's what we see.
And children in distress means what?
It can mean many things, but it generally plays out as a child who has behavioral issues in the classroom can be violent, verbally aggressive, and it's a huge concern. And what we're finding is the children come to us, the schools are being asked to deal with these children, and we've become, in a sense, therapeutic centers for children in crisis.
Is it a teacher safety issue? Is that your concern?
Yes, very much so. And I have to say, at once in my career, I had a letter put in my file with the board to say that I couldn't provide a safe environment in my classroom. And this was many years ago, but it sticks with me. I was afraid for the children in my room because I had a very distressed child who acted out and was violent. So if the schools are going to be a therapeutic center for children like this, fine and well, but we have to have that discussion, and we have to have the staff, we have to have the trained staff, we have to have the facilities, because for many of these children, a classroom is not a place where their needs can be met, at least initially.
Minister, this is one of the toughest nuts to crack in the
Absolutely.
School system. So, what can you tell her?
Yeah, well, what I can say is that it's partly about money, but we've put 34% more money, so about $550 million more into special education. So we're spending $2 billion on special education, and that means special assistance, equipment. We've put $43 million into the system for more psychologists, social workers. So it's partly about money, but I think it's more about how do we coordinate the services that touch these kids' lives. So if we look at autism, what we're doing in autism is the Minister of Children and Youth Services and I are working together to make sure that we have multidisciplinary teams wrapped around kids from the time they start into the school system and before they're in school, so that we can help those kids to adjust to the school, and you as the teacher can get some support from other agencies. We've got to make sure that the mental health agencies, Children's Aid Society, the health institutions, all of those organizations that are working with kids are working with the school so that the school isn't expected to do the whole thing.
It's a philosophical question as well, though, the whole issue of integration and how much of that you can expect to be successful?
Well, you know, there are always different schools of thought. We have fundamentally said that all things being equal, it's better to have a child with special needs integrated into a mainstream classroom. But there has to be a range of placements. We have congregated schools within the system. We have congregated classrooms, classrooms where kids with special needs are on their own outside of the mainstream classroom. So there is a range of placements, but the most important thing, and Carol has raised it, is we need trained people mm-hmm. to support teachers. So we need special needs assistants with training. We need psychologists and social workers. And so we've been putting more of those resources in. you know, is it perfect? Is it done? Is there the coordination that there needs to be? Not yet, but that's the path that we're
Annie,
on.
Annie, let me read this email to you, Annie, and get you to react to it. This is on the issue of special education. This came just to us via email from a teacher named Alex. Special education resources, Alex says, are a numbers game. Providing schools with these resources is based on numbers, which are hard to track year by year. If you remediate kids effectively, you remediate yourself out of a job. Then there will be nothing in place to help other incoming students in the years ahead. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I would question the total accuracy of it in terms of remediating yourself out of a job, but I do think that, you know, and notwithstanding, you know, the desire, I think, to make sure that there's kind of coordination for kids and that we're able to look at kids not in sort of here I'm health, here I'm mental health, here I'm education, here I'm social services. The idea or the ideal is there, but I'm not sure how much it's really actually happening on the ground. And so I think that it's so complicated, special education, and it's better than it was. I mean, we track waiting lists, for instance. They're not as big as they used to be, but they're still in the many thousands of kids waiting for assessment. There's still an issue in terms of the kind of dual that I can buy an assessment for my child if I have enough money. So there's a kind of two-tier system in special education, which really exists very strongly everywhere, where even if you're a parent in a school and you go, I think my kid needs a psychological or a psychoed assessment, principals will say to you, can you pay for it? Because go pay for it privately because the waiting lists are too long.
David,
so that's an issue.
How does it look from the elementary teacher's point of view?
Well, I agree with Annie. The wait list issue is there, and I can speak to it from my own personal experience. My son is a special needs student, and to be quite frank, if we didn't have the wherewithal to be able to get him the opportunity to get those assessments sooner, he'd have been on a very long wait list.
Yeah, my daughter too.
The wait lists are in some places in this province, as we understand it, are over a year to get assessment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know that there's a child in need. Without that assessment, they can't get the proper programming, and they continue to suffer. You know, we know that in the healthcare system, this government's been posed limits in terms of waiting periods. We think that maybe this is a place in the education system where there should be a guarantee that a child that's been identified as a teacher as needing an assessment gets it within a specified time so that child can actually be given the opportunity to learn.
Yeah, and I don't deny that that is an issue. We gave the Ontario Psychological Association $20 million to, and you know, most of the boards have reported that their wait times are down, but you're right, we don't have those benchmarks. What I can say is that even if it's uneven, it is happening. I mean, if we look at a board like Blue Water that has a wrap around Shelburne,
Owen Sound
area up there, you know, they have a system that's been in place for a number of years where all the providers from all the agencies work with the school board, and we're using that as a best practice and helping other boards to try to replicate it.
Ken?
Yeah, we have to be a little bit careful with that. We do represent support staff workers in our union as well, and one of the groups it's called PSSP, and those would be the psychologists, et cetera, that do these evaluations. And our belief is very much that they should be board-employed personnel. But I do agree with the minister, there are the remote areas where there just aren't enough people to provide those services. So part of our framework agreement for support staff took that into consideration. So we do have some language dealing with external agencies to make sure our members' jobs are protected, and we go forward from there.
Okay. One more policy issue that I'm just keeping an eye on the clock here. So what is the status of your government's plans to bring in all-day kindergarten across the province by September 2011?
So Charles Pascal is writing a report. Dr. Charles Pascal is writing a report for us. Yeah, to know him is to love him. And he's writing a report for us that we expect within the next few weeks. And he's going to be talking to us about what those models could look like. We're committed to beginning to implement full-day learning for 4 and 5-year-olds in September 2010 and continuing to implement it in 2011. I can't tell you at this point exactly what that's going to look like, but what we know is that if we can get those little kids into school for a full day, most of them are going to do better.
Will the current economic crisis derail these plans?
We have no intention to back off that implementation. And in fact, Steve, I would argue that given the economic situation, it's even more important that we make those investments because many of the kids we're talking about who need that programming the most are kids who are coming from backgrounds where they may not be ready, where they may be living in poverty, where they may not have the enrichment that they need. And so we need those kids in the school environment, in the learning environment.
Okay. Let me go to kind of the closing chapter of our discussion here today, outcomes and expectations. And one thing we know that this government came into office pledging to do was to improve student outcomes, get the test scores up, demonstrate greater numeracy and literacy skills. And with your indulgence here, we're going to go through some numbers, because the Education Quality and Assessment Office, EQAO, accountability, get my acronyms wrong all the time. Here we go. Percentage of grade 3 students at or above the provincial standard from 2003 to 2008. This is in the time that the McGuinty government has been in power, so since 2003. Reading up 7%, 7 percentage points, I should say. Writing skills up 8 percentage points. Math skills up 4 percentage points. Let's keep going. Percentage of grade 6 students at or above the provincial standard from 03 to 08. Reading up 8 percentage points, writing up 13 percentage points, math up 4 percentage points. Let's keep going. Percentage of all grade 9 students at or above the provincial standard. In the academic stream, up 7 percentage points. In the applied stream, up 8 percentage points. Let's take a look at the success rate in the secondary school literacy test. For those taking the test for the first time, October 03, when the McGuinty government came to power, 77% were doing it, passing on the first time. March 08, so these numbers admittedly a year old, but these are the most recent, 84%. Okay. What do you think of the numbers?
I think they're great. You know, I think what they say, no, I think, no, they're not good enough, especially if you look at some of the early ones, the math numbers, it's not good enough. We've got to do better. We've got to get those kids doing and learning their math skills earlier and better. But are we improving, and is the test one measure of that? Yes, absolutely.
Annie, what do you see in the numbers?
Well, there is improvement. They've kind of flatlined a bit over the last couple of years in terms of if just looking at the test scores. I think it is important in the grade 9 math to know with those applied kids that it's up, yes, but it's up from very, very low. So there's still kids really struggling in grade 9 math. I guess my worry about this as a measure of how we're doing in education, I go, this is one little teeny tiny, very narrow measure, and I don't buy it as a measure of the health of the system. I do really worry, and we've seen it in other countries, that you end up with a kind of two-tier curriculum, that you focus on the things you're testing for and the things you've promised as a political promise, reading, writing, and math, and that a lot of other things get you know, relegated down to the bottom tier, the arts, even social sciences, social studies, philosophy, world religion, some of the things that excite kids about school, the arts in particular in secondary school, and that's one of the things we're really looking for, is give us a bigger, broader vision that has a more fulsome description of what success looks like.
Now, Carol, you're teaching 1-2,
one
so
two.
This is not part of your world yet, but
no.
I'm sure you talk to your colleagues.
Yeah.
Do they teach the test to make sure the scores get higher?
I taught grade 3 when EQAO first came in. So, you know, after the first couple years, you know what's going to be on the test. It's hard not to. It's in the curriculum. Do we skip other things to teach to the test? I don't think so.
But you can't do it all, so you probably have to, don't you?
We can't do any. Even without the test, we couldn't do it all.
Right.
And that's
that's an important point.
That
and
is,
we actually have put in place a review of the elementary curriculum because,
which is wonderful.
You know, that's something that has been called for, and it's very necessary. There's a lot in the curriculum, a lot of things that teachers have to cover, and I think we have to look at what are the concepts, what are the basic skills, and give teachers the ability to.
We cover a broad area in terms of subject matter, where maybe we should cover a few things or fewer things in more depth, I think.
What do you see in the numbers, David?
Well, I see this obsession with those test scores. I mean, it's a political promise, and that political promise is driving what's happening, at least in public elementary schools, to a very large extent. Our teachers are inundated with initiatives that are focused on raising test scores. They're saying that we have full plates today. Government has set another priority. What is the government telling us we should no longer be trying to do? Because trying to do it all means that sooner or later the system collapses, and we're faced with a problem. That's part of the reason why we've been saying that we need equal resources so that we can have the breadth of other areas covered.
But parents obviously wanted to see some tangible evidence that little Johnny and Janie were learning better. Well, is this not it?
Well, this is a very simplistic way of doing it. I think the tangible evidence is to get to know your teacher and have those conversations on an ongoing basis, and not just about literacy and numeracy, but about the breadth of what goes on in that school environment. I mean, parents don't come to school to watch their children write tests. They come to watch them engage in other activities.
And let's hear from Ken first. Go ahead.
David and I don't always agree, but we do on this one. We are very much opposed to standardized testing. And unfortunately, what happens is institutes such as the Fraser Institute use those mm-hmm. results to rank schools, which is very harmful. Now, that's outside of the government's ability to
control. And EQAO isn't the Fraser.
Correct. Now, EQAO, though, I believe their budget last year was $37 million.
Half of what it was 32. When we came in.
So it's coming down. But it's even being reviewed right now, I think, by the Auditor General's office. So
What's your point here, though?
Well, my point is it's a lot of money that's being spent on a standardized test which provides a snapshot of the student's education. It's supposed to be used for diagnostic purposes, and I think to some degree it is happening.
Mm-hmm. How would you mm-hmm. satisfy the parental need to see some objective measure of how their children are doing?
I see it every time my daughter brings her report card mm-hmm. home.
So, Steve, there, you know, the ranking of schools is not something we have ever supported.
Yep.
And people say, well, don't give the results to the newspapers. Well, the newspapers will get them on freedom of information, and then we'll be accused of trying to hide something. So we give them the newspapers, they do what they will with them, and that's as it is. But you know what's really interesting to me is when I go into schools, and I go into elementary and primary classrooms, and I see teachers teaching language in a different way than they did 5 years ago. My background is in linguistics, and I see teachers understanding language acquisition in a way that they didn't before. That's because we've got different ways of professional development. There's more embedded learning. New teachers are getting support. So that kind of learning, that's a huge success story. And it's that teacher practice that's informing the ability of the kids. Reading is a fundamental skill. If kids can't read, they're not going to succeed, and we've got to do the same with math.
And I guess, I mean, it's A, not putting all your eggs in that basket. There's other ways of doing it. You can do sample testing as opposed to testing everybody. But I want to go back to David's point,
do sample testing,
yeah.
It's not going to be a diagnosis.
No,
but
you can do it in different ways. But the pressure on, and because you know who's not here is any principals, actually, now that I think of it. And the pressure on principals in terms of their test scores, and maybe coming up after the governance review on school boards as a performance measure, is really big. And principals talk about it a lot, that they feel that they are getting a lot of, sort of directives about getting their test scores up and what they have to look like and the progress they have to make over years just in terms of those test scores, so that it's hard then in a system where there's a lot of pressure anyway to go, I want to be able to make sure that I'm providing everything I want to be able to provide in terms of engagement and a lot of other stuff, but if I got to get those scores up, I'm going to, again, you end up focusing all on that, so it's a problem.
Let me do a follow-up for the minister on this as well. And you've heard this criticism, and I've heard it too. The frequent criticism is that you've softened up on the standards, and that's one of the reasons why these test scores are higher.
No, the EQAO is, it's an arm's length body. They develop the test, they look at the curriculum, they develop the questions. So that's not something that the government has control over.
Well,
so that's they're shorter than they were. But what we're trying to do is make them more possible. More possible for the kids to be able to succeed, because a kid having anxiety about writing a test because it's going to last 5 or 6 days, that's not productive, and that doesn't demonstrate their ability.
There is an alternative to the grade 10 literacy test, right? There's a course now that you can take for those who don't pass the test. So if you can do a course, which is presumably easier to pass than a test, which may, take into account all of the nervousness and stress of the moment, isn't that a softening of the standards?
No, what we said was, if there's a student for whom the test is not possible, but they actually can demonstrate the skills by taking the course, then why wouldn't we want them to demonstrate those skills so that they can pass? I think that is actually an indication of how we understand how kids learn.
Okay, but again,
right?
I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
Because life doesn't work that way. Sometimes you don't get the choice between doing it the easy way or the hard way in life. You got to do it the hard way.
I'd suggest it's just a different way. I wouldn't suggest it's necessarily
harder
an easy
or
way.
Just
for
different.
Some kids, give me the test and let me get out of here.
Yeah.
Don't make me take a course because I'll be bored to death. Let me write the test and it's over because I've got that skill set. It's just a different set of skills.
Let me raise some issues now around dropouts. Dropouts was a huge issue before this government came to power, and they passed a law saying that you got to stay in school till you're 18 or you can't have your driver's license. which seems to have helped in some significant way.
That provision was taken out.
That was taken out?
That was taken out.
Okay, appreciate the clarification.
And also, before we even put the legislation...
Can he do that?
Yeah.
He did do that.
He planned on doing that.
He planned to do it, and they took it out.
Then there were hearings,
okay.
And then it changed.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm glad you clarified. Okay.
But the other thing is, before we brought the legislation in, we put programs in place. The programs are what are important.
Well, let's put the numbers up for starters. Let's go to this. Here's board three. More grads, fewer dropouts. 2003-04, the graduation rate was 68%. That's the year the McGuinty government came into power. 2004-05, 71%. 2005-06, go ahead, unroll this if you can. 2005-06, 73%. 2006-07, 75%. 2007-08, 77%. I thought it was because you were denying driver's licenses, but apparently that had nothing to do with it.
Those kids really want to drive.
really wanted to. Why do you think there are fewer dropouts these days, David?
Well, one of the statistics in there, as I understand it, is it's a four-year high school program, but students are there 5 years quite often, and that's included in there. But I think that the idea of keeping students in school until age 18 is one thing, but our point has always been it's about engagement. I mean, being there physically doesn't mean that you're engaged. And again, from the elementary student's perspective, we need to engage them at that age so that when they get to high school, they're not looking at the clock, so to speak,
so
waiting to get out.
Is there more student engagement happening now, and that's why they're hanging around longer?
Well, I think they're hanging around longer because the demands of society are such that having a five-year program versus a four-year program is a bit of an academic question as opposed to a real question.
Ken?
Well, we've got a little problem with some of those statistics, and it all revolves around credit integrity. And, you know, does the student actually achieve the marks to graduate, or are those marks being given to them? And that is a big issue that I know the government is focused on. We've certainly raised it with the government, with the ministry, and they're taking steps to make sure they're reviewing the whole process of assessment, evaluation, and reporting. We have concerns such as, you know, should you not be able to give a student zero? Should you not be able to deduct marks for late projects? All issues like that could have a bearing as to the final mark, which obviously then, escalates to the graduation rate. So we want to make sure that credit integrity is taken care of.
Usha George from Ryerson University was on this program a while ago, back in September, and spoke to this very issue. So let's play this clip, and then we'll come back and talk. Roll tape, please.
At the first year level, we find a large number of students actually struggling as to how to do an essay, how to write properly, even the notions of what is your idea as opposed to somebody else's idea, how to, you know, quote someone. All of those are major issues in our first year classes. I'm not saying all students actually go through this, but definitely a large number of them. In fact, in many of the universities, especially at Ryerson, we are focusing on the first year students and helping them to write. In my faculty, we have a special intervention for all the first year students too.
That's a bit shocking.
1983, I taught language skills at Humber College, and I had kids in my class who were English speakers, had graduated from high school. I was teaching them to write a sentence and write a paragraph. So I think, you know, we have to just take it all with a little bit of a grain of salt. I think there are, you know, there have been historically those. It's not a new thing. The reason I believe that, and what we know from the Canadian Council on Learning, when they looked at what we've done in terms of student success, we've got student success teachers, one in every high school at least, who is paying attention to kids who are at risk of not passing. We've got more co-op programs, we've got more hands-on learning, we've got specialist high skills majors, we've got dual credits where kids can be at college and at high school at the same time with a secondary teacher attached to them, but they get a view of what's happening in college and they might go on. So those kinds of engagement strategies are, I believe, the things that are keeping kids in school.
And I only want to give partial credit for, I think the graduation rates are real. I don't agree that everybody else drops out, and I think it's really bad to assume that the rest of them are dropouts. Some kids take a long time to graduate. That, yes, there are, I think that high schools, there are more people in high schools trying to assist kids. There is an issue, you know, we have to think about the credit thing, but support is good. But on the other hand, I think the real reason the graduation rate's gone up, and it was predicted at the beginning, is the graduation rate plummeted before then because new curriculum was introduced halfway through, you know, when kids were, suddenly they got a whole new curriculum in grade 9. So finally the curriculum, the kids have caught up with the new curriculum so that they are prepared by elementary school. So people said the graduation rates will go back up, and they have. But high schools, I think there are more supports in high schools too, but I don't think it's something to, you know, maybe the crowing could be a little less loud.
We did a show on post-secondary education a while ago, and one of the things we learned is that nobody fails in university or community college. You don't fail. Can you flunk somebody in high
what?
School?
In university?
Yeah, they don't know, they don't flunk anybody.
My daughter's friends have failed in university. Sorry.
Well, no?
Yeah, you can fail in university.
Okay, guy came in here, wrote a book about it, James Cote.
Oh, yeah, but he...
Says nobody fails anymore.
Oh,
can you flunk high school now?
Well, sure. I mean, and kids leave high school, and kids get discouraged. And as Annie says, there are lots of kids who leave when they're 18. They haven't graduated. They come back. This 4-year versus 5-year thing, I think, is just a straw man. You know, I think it's not the issue. The issue is, are we helping more kids and more young adults get the credentials and the diplomas that they need to go on to do what they want to do in their lives? The answer is yes. And that's a good thing.
You agree with that?
I do. I mean, what students like to see is an extensive curriculum. They like to be able to choose the courses that interest them. And the more staff we have that can provide those courses, the more the students will stay in school. Success breeds success, kind of thing.
And so that's why some of them come back for the 5th year. You know, my conservative critic is on me the last few days because of this 4 and 5 years. And you know, that the point is that if a child wants to come back and take a drama course or a music course or another physics class that they couldn't fit into their timetable, how can that be a bad thing if it means that they'll go on to do what they want to do?
We got less than 5 minutes to go here, and I want to put just a couple of more kind of bigger picture questions on the table. Carol, let me go to you first on this. How hard do you think it is to change the public's perception of the public education system?
Oh. The only way it can be done is through personal experience and people talking to people. You know, every parent that a teacher talks to, every child who is helped, it's not easy. It can't be done by policy. So no, it's not easy, and but I think we all do it every day. It's certainly part of my job. It's part of every teacher's job, and that's the only way I can address that.
David?
Well, I think if you know anything about Ontario's history, we've become a very successful and wealthy province because of two things. One, public education, and second, the ability to have electricity early in this century, in the last century. But there have always been critics of public education, and there always will be. The reality is the overwhelming majority of citizens in Ontario go through the public school system, and they're prosperous. They encounter good and bad things about it. But I think the real test is the overwhelming support that still remains for public schools. And we saw that in the 90s when that was challenged, and the public reacted. People like Annie came to the forefront to take up the challenge to say, no, this is a system that is inherently part of our democracy and fundamentally good for everything that we are about in Ontario.
I want to make sure everybody gets in on this, so slightly shorter answers. Can you on that one, please?
I think it all revolves around the word respect. The government respects the educational workers, the educational mm-hmm. workers respect the students, and it's a cycle that will continue. That's where you get success.
Annie?
Well, I also think that we could be better at sort of making the connections to everybody else so that everybody understands why they have a stake in the health and the strength of the public education system. And I mean, we've been working on a sort of new conversation about schools in the 21st century to get people excited about the potential that's there in schools, the possibility that's there, because I think people take them a bit for granted and think they're only a concern of parents or teachers or people directly involved. And we want to broaden that.
That was one of the things you wanted to do, obviously, when you came to office, is change the public's perception of public education. How hard is it to do?
Well, you know, I think one of the most important things we do is have community use of schools so that people can come into schools and use them. The whole notion of community hubs, schools as community hubs, where people come in and there are different services and there's the ability to connect with the community through the school. I think that's extremely important. 95% of kids in Ontario go to publicly funded schools. It's an incredibly equitable, when you look at other parts of the world, equitable, high quality education system, and people want that.
You're talking here about public education, publicly funded separate education, right? Between the secular and the Catholic.
We've got four systems.
French and English.
French and English, public and Catholic.
And that's 95% of Ontario's children.
95% of kids go to publicly funded schools. So, you know, a young family first child, they're going to assume that they can send their child to the local publicly funded school. And that's a hugely important aspect of our democracy, I believe.
We've got, and I'm going to give it to you, we've got about a minute and change left here. What's still the biggest thing left undone in your job?
Oh, there's so many things that we still have to do. We've got to make sure in this diverse province of ours that we have the most equitable and inclusive system possible. And I'm not talking about inclusion in the narrow terms of special education. I'm talking about making sure that everybody feels that they belong, that they are part of the education system. And I think we have a challenge with our geography and, you know, the fact that we have a declining enrollment in across the province, 90,000 fewer students this year than in 2003-2004, is an opportunity to do just what I was talking about, creating community hubs, making sure that schools stay vibrant. There will still be schools that close, but the grand experiment, the project of publicly funded education, needs to survive this economic downturn and this declining enrollment. That's the challenge that's in front of us.
And that's the last word on our program tonight. Can I thank all of you for coming in and sharing your views with us this evening? Kathleen Wynne, the Minister of Education, Annie Kidder, People for Education. On the other side of the table, David Clegg from ETFO, Carol Solomon, Catholic teacher, and Ken Korn from OSSTF. Thanks so much, everybody. And I would say parenthetically, we love having ministers on this program. Few of them choose to come on with other people, particularly the heads of unions. So kudos to you for doing it. And go back to cabinet and tell those other chickens that they ought to come on and do this program, okay? A couple of them have.
I didn't even know I had the choice to say no.
You don't. But somehow they think they do. Anyway, now a couple of your colleagues have, but not enough. But so thanks, everybody, for doing this tonight.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin was presented by
Valley Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca.